Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
Stu does America.
Follow the show on YouTube, youtube.com/StuDoesAmerica. Make sure to subscribe and hit the bell for notifications. Daniel Horowitz is here with the latest on Obamacare's failures and the Israel ceasefire. The Democrats are getting ready to go to war with their own John Fetterman. We'll look at the latest in Pennsylvania, but we start by doing racist redistricting. Mm-hmm. It's time to get into it. This is a Supreme Court case you may have not been following, but it's a pretty big deal. Supreme Court case that could hand the House to Republicans, says the New York Times. Republicans have been redrawing congressional districts this year at President Trump's behest, but so far hasn't seemed to be enough to deny Democrats a reasonable path to control the House of Representatives. That might change if the Supreme Court strikes down Section 2 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act in Louisiana versus Calais, a case that the court heard on Wednesday. Without Section 2, which has been interpreted to require the creation of majority-minority districts, so a district in Congress that is a majority of, you know, what various minority groups, Republicans could eliminate upward of a dozen Democratic-held districts across the South. Now, here is the scare map from the New York Times. This is what could happen. What you see on the current map, if you're listening on podcasts, it's a current map, is the southeast of the United States and a bunch of blue districts kind of mixed in there. What could happen if they do this? Well, Republicans could gain 12 more seats, including 9 without Section 2 of the VRA, Voting Rights Act. Now, if you see that map, it's mostly red. And that's, of course, evil. Red equals evil, unless we're talking about communism. Then it's wonderful. Now, they have this little kind of flow chart. It's a little difficult to understand, but I'll try to walk you through it here real quick. Basically, they're saying they're expecting Texas, Missouri, and Utah to redistrict, and that will make it so that the national popular vote would need to be won by Democrats by 1.3 points to get the House. So normally you think, okay, well, if they just win it, probably there's a good chance they're going to win the House. They're going to have to win that House by a little bit larger margin of 1.3%. Now, if California fights back, they'd only have to win by 0.2%. But then there's Florida, Indiana, Ohio, and Kansas that might go and give more seats to Republicans. So the Democrats would have to win by 1.4%. But if Section 2 is struck down, it could be between 4.4 and 5.6% that the Democrats would have to win by in the national popular vote just to barely win the House. And if California doesn't do any of this, their redistricting, which could still fail, we'll get into the polling on that here in a second, but 5.1 to 6.1% they'd have to win by. So if you picture a country where Democrats are winning the popular vote by 6 points and maybe still losing the House, they don't like that very much, which is why they're very, very pissed off and scared. Democrats panic over redistricting numbers with pivotal SCOTUS decision looming. Now, look, there's a lot that goes into this whole decision. We don't have time to go through the ins and outs of every little piece of this and how it's twisted and turned over the years. But what I will say is the interpretation that the United States is required to create districts based on the color of someone's skin is on its face insane, right? Like the whole point of all, I thought the lesson we all learned from back in the day was picking things like this based on skin color, bad idea, right? That was supposed to be bad. Now what the left will say is, well, it was bad for a long time. And now we have to go the other way to make it right. And of course, this logic is held by some. Ibram Kendi is one of them. The good old classic, the only cure for past discrimination is current discrimination. The only cure for current discrimination is future discrimination. In other words, discrimination's fine, as long as it gets us to where we want to go. In fact, we shouldn't just get rid of discrimination now. We should discriminate against white people, against evil Republicans, against the South, or whatever you want it to be. Because in reality, they were bad to us, 100 years ago. Now, all of this, to me, doesn't make much sense, honestly. I think the quicker path to us not thinking about these things, that often would be the better path. Whatever the fastest road is to us never having to have a conversation about race ever again is the best path forward to me, because all that does is make people focus on it. And if you think, kind of stop and think about it for a minute, none of it makes any sense. Right? Like, we could pick any number of immutable characteristics that we all have, and filling that into this conversation would make no sense. Like, if I were to say we are required to draw congressional districts to make sure there's a majority of people who have green eyes instead of blue or black or brown, then, well, you know, we have to do that because that's what the Constitution guarantees. We'd all say that's insane. If I said, well, we got to have those brown hair districts, we'd all say, what? What are you talking about? What does the color of the hair have to do with the person, the individual? Yeah, that's kind of the point. What does the color of the skin have to do with the individual? The color of the skin is just another one of these immutable characteristics. Just because we notice it a little bit more makes no difference. Should we have majority bald districts? Does that make any sense? Yes, I am getting, there's a lot of bald people here, so I'm getting some nodding on that particular one. But the bottom line is that none of that makes sense because these are characteristics that don't make up the man. They don't make up the person. They don't make up, we don't even do this with gender. What if they did a majority female district? Everyone would be like, wait, what? That doesn't make any sense. You don't do that. It's not the foundation of an individual. And these are all supposed to be decisions made by individuals. And that's what people are. They're individuals that make up these groups. We recognize that as conservatives. They don't, because they see people not as individuals, but as members of groups. It is part of the collective. Racism is collectivism. That's what it is. It's just another form. So when you hear all these people, they're like, oh, these people on the far right that are all racist. No, they're not. It's impossible to be racist if you're adopting a situation where you're focusing on individuals. You can hate a person of an individual race, not based on the color of their skin, but based on who they are. You can hate them. You can think they're annoying. You can think they're incompetent. You can think they're stupid. But it's not about the skin color. Of course, the Supreme Court can't make a lot of those arguments. It's really more based on the law and the Constitution, not just what the obvious thing should be. Neil Gorsuch was there. He got the NAACP lawyer to all but admit support for racial discrimination in redistricting. Again, this is Ibram Kendi and his mantra that he, by the way, was people noticed that it was his mantra, and they noticed it, and they kept saying what his mantra was, so he took it out of the reprints of his book. I kid you not, that's a real story. Here is Neil Gorsuch talking to the NAACP lawyer, Janai Nelson.
Sometimes federal district courts order maps, and you're saying sometimes acceptable for a federal district court to order a map that intentionally discriminates on the basis of race?
I disagree with that formulation. So first and foremost, states and plaintiffs, as they put forth illustrative maps, cannot put forth maps that discriminate and that use race in an excessive fashion.
Excessive.
The only actor that has broader leeway are states, because we give states breathing room. We give states wide latitude in order to balance their political interests and concerns.
So federal district courts can't discriminate on the basis of race in remedies, but states can?
Federal district courts can only order maps that are constitutional. And again, the constitutional boundaries are between Jingles and Shaw, which sometimes permits
states
race.
States have more breathing room. So do they have the breathing room to intentionally discriminate on the basis of race?
They don't have breathing room to intentionally discriminate on the basis of race. They have breathing room to use race to remedy their own discrimination.
Okay, thank you.
So the only solution to past discrimination is current discrimination. She just outlined exactly that concept, even though she tries to deny it in the strongest terms possible. Also, there was a situation with the same lawyer going back and forth, talking about the real problems here. And I guess the real problems is white Democrats aren't voting for the right colors.
That's right. And in the state of Louisiana, that analysis was conducted in the Nairn case. And it was clear that regardless of party, white Democrats were not voting for black candidates, whether they were Democrats or not. And we know that there is such a significant chasm between how black and white voters vote in Louisiana that there's no question that even if there is some correlation between race and party, that race is the driving factor.
Quite the accusation there. Many baseless accusations just kind of floated out there about white people in general or black people in general. I think they were all pretty awful because when you generalize like that, you usually get things wrong. And I had mentioned earlier that, you know, look, you can. You should talk about the person as an individual. You can think someone's annoying as an individual. You can hate somebody as an individual. You can think someone's stupid as an individual. Case in point, Ketanji Brown Jackson is in the Supreme Court currently. Not exactly sure why. I don't think anyone really knows, except for the fact that this catchy song came out of all of it.
Ketanji Brown Jackson, she is for real. Never had a justice quite like her. She's a former public defender. Ketanji Brown Jackson, she is for real. Harvard graduate at the circuit court and the trial court. She knows the score. Ketanji Brown Jackson, she is for real. Many a day has gone by with no black female voice. Want the most qualified? KBJ's a clear choice. Clerked at all three levels of the judiciary. That's way more than can be said for Miss Amy Coney. Barrett pushed it faster than Cancun Cruz when he fled. So spare us all that bullshit like you thought we forget. KBJ is the GOAT. Oh, you want an explanation? Let's look at how much they all did before the nominations. KBJ's years of experience, she judged for 8.9. Yeah, that's more than Thomas Roberts, Kagan, and Barrett combined.
So Ketanji Brown Jackson is in the Supreme Court, as I was saying, and she she's worried that being black is basically like a disability. KBJ suggests black people can't vote and compares them to the disabled. If you don't believe that that's true, I'll play another clip for you, and I promise you it will not be that song.
I guess I'm thinking of it, of the fact that remedial action, absent discriminatory intent, is really not a new idea in the civil rights laws. And my kind of paradigmatic example of this is something like the ADA. Congress passed the Americans with Disabilities Act against the backdrop of a world that was generally not accessible to people with disabilities. And so it was discriminatory in effect because these folks were not able to access these buildings. And it didn't matter whether the person who built the building or the person who owned the building intended for them to be exclusionary. That's irrelevant. Congress said the facilities have to be made equally open to people with disabilities if readily possible. I guess I don't understand why that's not what's happening here. The idea in Section 2 is that we are responding to current day manifestations of past and present decisions that disadvantage minorities and make it so that they don't have equal access to the voting system, right? They're disabled. In fact, we use the word disabled in Milligan. We say that's a way in which you see that these processes are not equally open.
Okay. Actually, the song might have been better. After listening to that blather. This is, again, right down that same line from Ibram Kendi, right? It's not about whether someone is actually racist, right? The fact that they're white and have the benefits of this evil society is racist in and of itself. The effect is racist, so therefore the intent doesn't matter. And of course, when you're talking about racism, intent is really, in some ways, all that matters. It's about whether you are trying. Why are you doing a thing? If you don't date someone of a different race, are you dating them because you're not attracted to them? Are you dating them because you're not dating them because you're not attracted to them? Are you not dating them because you don't find them charming? Or are you not dating them because they're black, right? Like, that's a totally different thing that you shouldn't do. At least, you know, it's like a bizarre sort of parallel to what she's talking about there. It's not about the race of the person. It's about what the individual person wants to do. And if a white person decides they want to vote for a white candidate or they want to vote for a black candidate, that should be their choice. And you don't need to restructure and micromanage and reverse engineer the result you're looking for. You have to live with what people's choices are in a democracy, or at least the elements of the democracy that fall within our constitutional republic. A couple more things before we go. Prop 50 opponents and supporters are fighting for their side as the special election approaches. This is California. Let me give you these polls. Recent statewide poll from Coefficient shows 54% of California voters in favor of Prop 50, 36% opposed. Now, this is interesting mainly because at the beginning it was the opposite of this. In California, they were saying, well, gosh, I don't want to do this redistricting. I want the fair way. I don't want to do this in some political way like you're trying to do it. And Gavin Newsom spent, you know, tens of millions of dollars to get advertising out there and convinced a bunch of far left people to sort of change their mind to say, oh, actually, now we do want the unfair way. So that's kind of where we are on that, to the point where, you know, there are reports of Republicans just pulling ads off the air. They don't think they have any chance of winning this. So you should expect about five seats to go toward the Democrats in that particular redistricting. By the way, this is now the seventh most expensive ballot measure in California's history. $139.9 million raised so far. That's the seventh biggest one. You worry about a lot of money in politics. The left always says they're so concerned about that until they can use it to their advantage. Then they're thrilled about it. So that's where we are right now. The redistricting thing is going to be interesting. I think we're in a full nuclear release at this point. Every state that has an opportunity to do this is likely going to do it. Everyone's going to max out their own states. At the end of the day, that should wind up falling toward the Republicans' benefit. But if this particular case does get overturned and we go back to a place where we're not judging by people by the color of their skin, but instead the content of their character, if that's the actual ruling of the Supreme Court, then it may even be larger for Republicans and maybe a bigger gain for the right. So we'll get into more of that as we get closer to it. Daniel Horowitz is also going to join us. We've got Israel to talk about. We've got Qatar to talk about, and Obamacare as well. We'll get into that with Daniel next. When you need a pharmacy, you can usually find one, right? At least for now. Because who's to say that if there's a disaster or a supply chain event or anything like that, that this doesn't change on you in an instant? And that's what Jace Medical is here for. They help you prepare for the kinds of medical disruptions you can't predict by giving you access to emergency supplies of the medications your family relies on most. We're talking, you know, real prescriptions dispensed by real doctors and pharmacists for a curated set of essential antibiotics and, you know, all sorts of other long-term use medications, enough to get you through the kind of situation that would leave most people scrambling. I know I've had the situation before myself, you know, on vacation at night in a small town and no pharmacies are open and having to drive 45 minutes to an hour to just get basic medication for my son who was sick in the middle of the night. You don't want that to happen. Have the stuff from Jace Medical. You don't have to worry about that. Jace, you can be completely prepared ahead of time and ready for action when disaster strikes. Head out and get one today. Go to jace.com. Use the code STU at checkout. You'll get a discount on your order. The promo code is STU at jace.com. JASE.com. The promo code is STU.
Achtung, es folgt eine wichtige Botschaft Ihres Mobilfunkanbieters.
Ey Mann, es gibt Leute, die drücken immer noch zu viel Knitter ab.
Nein, nicht frisch.
Der Barra ist ja irgendwie smarter.
Ja, smart.
50 Gigabyte für nur 8,99.
Wenig Knete.
Ich zahle doch nicht mehr für weniger.
Nee, das wäre auch schön blöd.
Le
Barra, deine Knete, deine Entscheidung.
Nice.
Alle Details zu unseren Tarifen finden Sie unter lebara.de.
I want to bring in Daniel Horowitz. He is the senior editor for Blaze News and host of the Blaze podcast Conservative Review, which you can subscribe to wherever you get your podcasts. Also has a new piece out at the Blaze right now. It's Obamacare was never affordable and neither is cowardice. So be sure to check that out. Daniel, thanks for coming back on the program.
Hey, great to be back. So much to discuss.
Yes, I appreciate it. You bring us back into the, you gave me a little flashback to 2013. I don't know if it was a positive flashback. I do remember those times quite clearly when, you know, you have Obamacare passes
And there's a period of time, as you point out in the piece, it's the period before the dependence really begins for the average person and Obamacare, where the law is still unpopular. There's still a chance for us to do something about it. Ted Cruz tries, Mike Lee tries, and unfortunately, the Republicans don't hold up their end of the bargain.
You know, it's really sad and nostalgic watching nowadays what's going on in light of that, because this was the ultimate illustration of how the Democrats operate economically and how they've been doing it for years. They do slash and burn, divide and conquer. So they go and get their you know, tentacles into the private sector, create monopolies, drive up prices, and then people feel the pain. They want relief. They don't care why. They don't necessarily remember why, but they want relief. And then Democrats get to come in and say, hey, look, isn't it expensive? We need to give more handouts, go into more debt, and that triggers more inflation, and rinse and repeat. And what's so sad, I was just talking to a friend recently, there's probably so many youngsters in their 20s that don't even know why premiums are the way they are now. It's so obvious to us what caused it. So the trap that Republicans are in is that people, all they know is that insurance is unaffordable. So Democrats are saying, look, they're taking away the morphine from you. We're willing to offer morphine. And my point is, you can't ignore that issue. You can't negotiate down, well, we'll just offer this amount or that amount. It's do or die moment. They will get blamed for higher prices. You may as well use this opportunity to go for the touchdown, to repeal the entire law, not just say, I won't extend the Biden COVID era extra subsidies, but to actually repeal the actuarially insolvent regulations of the law that make insurance so expensive to begin with.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, because we talked about that a little bit over the past couple of weeks, because I think what people are hearing about this government shutdown is that the government shut down because, Democrats are fighting for your health care and Republicans want to make your health care prices go up. That's how, of course, the media is covering it. And I don't think a lot of people have even gone into the details that what they're talking about doing is extending massive subsidies to people that were based on, you know, near peak COVID times. You know, it was the Biden era, so it was a little bit after peak COVID. But they were trying to extend COVID into infinity. And then they extended it again in the Inflation Reduction Act to 2025. And now they just want to make these things go on forever. These were subsidies that were supposed to be for people during a pandemic, number one. And number two, it's for people that go up to six-figure salaries. I mean, this is not, yep, we're not talking about the poor here.
No, I mean, it's 100% covered for those up to 150% of the federal poverty level, mm-hmm, and ranging from 80% to 93% sliding scale for those up to, what is it, 800%, which for a family of five would be about $300,000 of income. Mm-hmm. And what they're trying to tell you is, look, you know, prices are skyrocketing now because we won't extend the subsidies. Like, no, that's like saying is I'm stabbing a patient with a knife and then with the other hand administering a morphine, saying, well, hey, you're taking away the morphine. Well, how about you stop causing the problem? Right. That needs to be the message, because the bottom line is Democrats are banking on the fact that Obamacare is unaffordable and people don't remember what caused that. And they're feeling the pain and they can't afford it. And here's the thing. For years, we've debated the size and scope of a safety net during the Reagan era and thereafter, Gingrich era. For better, for worse, the Democrats got what they wanted. OK, we have Medicare. We have 70 million people now on Medicaid and CHIP. And then you have VA, you have all different programs. So you've already covered those people. Is it too much to ask that we have a remaining sliver that is not regulated and not subsidized, where people could shop with choices and competition and not pay a fortune? And Stu, there's another important thing that people forget, in that the other half of this is the employer side. People think, oh, okay, it's the individuals, they need to be taken care of because Obamacare made it completely unaffordable. But the employer side is unaffordable too. most employers are putting in $25,000 to $30,000, some sort of mix of you paying and they paying, but it's you're paying all of it. That $30,000 is coming out of you in the form of salary. It's not free. You would be making more money, and people need to be made to understand that, that if only they could get their full salary and then be able to go out on the open market, purchase something for more like $7,000 a year or so for a family, and then pay as you go for as you need it, you would have so much more money, but also so much more quality choice that you're not tethered to a particular profession or a particular time period for your healthcare.
It's unbelievable. It really is a very strange situation. And of course, the Republicans will screw it up one way or the other. Let me switch gears here real quick, Daniel, to the Middle East. We obviously had the hostage deal. I'm certain you're very happy that the hostages are home, but it's a pretty complicated deal. Do we look at this as a positive long term? Do we think it's going to work out? And, you know, how do you see the reaction to it so far?
You know, it's interesting. I think there's two parts to this. There's the short-term actual details of the plan and what triggered it. And then there's a longer-term trend of, wait a minute, where's this coming from and where is this headed? Short-term, whether you like it or not, Israel was boxed in. They were boxed in the sense that they thought with the Democrats out of power, they would have a free hand, and they kind of didn't have a free hand. It was certainly a lot better than under Biden. And Israel is not allowed to finish wars. Okay, I mean, we saw that with Iran. They had another week or two. I think they could have finished them off. Same thing with Lebanon, and same thing here. So they were caught at a stalemate where they couldn't really go full force. But on the other hand, they weren't getting back the hostages, which in Israeli culture seems to be the end all. I mean, I kind of question how much they, you know, give into it. And sometimes that encourages more hostage taking. But that's how their society is. And that's what they wanted. So Trump came in and said, look, if you want them back, here's what we're going to do. Hamas leadership will survive. But we're going to try to make it that this time is different. You're not going to pull out of security corridors right away. And we're going to make sure they demilitarize. And we're going to make sure they uphold their end of the bargain. So once again, Israel had to release, I don't know, what was it? 1-to-100 ratio. I mean, the same thing. But now Hamas doesn't have a hostage. I think the one difference is that before Israel was handcuffed, this time they did seriously degrade them. It's not like they can come back around a few weeks later and start shooting rockets like every other time. And I think that's why they ultimately took it, even though, you know, there's questions about it. The longer term issue is there's too much Qatari influence. I'm just going to say it straight out. You want to get Egypt, UAE, Jordan involved. That makes sense. They hate the Muslim Brotherhood. They actually banned the Muslim Brotherhood. They certainly have every vested interest in making sure that Hamas does not rebuild. The problem is that Qatar and Turkey are intimately involved in this. And I think that's question number one. What is their involvement? Because their number one priority will be to rebuild Hamas. And also they have back channels with Iran to continue their influence. Number two, I think the questions Americans should be asking is this. Stu, I'm sure you're very well acquainted with the online right over the last year or so, turning on a dime. I mean, not just, okay, let's move one or two tranches away, not so much of a focus on Israel, to like the full communist Islamist BLM Antifa Free Palestine sort of stuff. I mean, that's what we've seen by some of our colleagues in this industry. So I was told that Israel is really not in America's interest. All right, okay, I'll bite. But then by a factor of a million, isn't rebuilding Gaza not in our best interest? Meaning, shouldn't we stay the hell out of that? My concern is, what, forget about why Israel did or didn't accept it. That's their business. My concern is, from an America First standpoint, the AP reported, and DOD did not deny this, that they're sending 200 troops. Now, they did say they're not going to be in Gaza. Let's take that face value for now. But what the hell are they doing? Like, I thought the whole point was, we're sick of deploying our troops to the Middle East. We're sick of endless wars. We're sick of foreign entanglements. So that, I mean, if we're not going to go to bat for Israel, which honestly we never really were on the hook for, they were doing the work themselves. We were handcuffing them. It's not like Ukraine where we put 3 years worth of 150 billion of weapons and nothing happens. They were getting the job done. But then why are we going to bat for Gaza? And what is this rebuild Gaza? What is this humanitarian aid? I mean, as conservatives, do we want to give aid to Gaza? I never thought that was a thing. So that's what concerns me from an American standpoint.
There is a lot to be concerned about. And a long road ahead of us, Daniel. I mean, it's great to be excited about the hostages coming home. Of course, we're happy about that. But there's a lot to watch here, and we're going to continue to do it. I know you're going to be doing it on your podcast as well. Daniel Horowitz, Blaze News Senior Editor. Be sure to catch him on the Blaze Podcast Conservative Review. You can subscribe there wherever you get your podcasts. And, of course, head to theblaze.com. Check out his new piece on Obamacare. Obamacare was never affordable, and neither is cowardice. Daniel, appreciate taking your time and you taking the time and going through all of this with us.
Always enjoy it. Take care.
John Fetterman is still criticizing his fellow Democrats over the shutdown. He says he follows country, then party. Maybe not following party at all was probably the best outcome. But again, it is good sentiment there from John Fetterman. He wants to talk about health care. And it's hard to read quotes from John because they, you know, he's still having his issues. And they so much of it is like parenthetical, like inserts of things he didn't say to explain what he did say. Anyway, that's his feeling. And of course, Democrats don't like that. There's a new scoop out of Axios today. Dems plot Fetterman ouster. What are they trying to do? They're trying to find more liberal Democrats to run against John Fetterman, going after him and criticizing him more openly and trying to do eventually just defeat him so he's no longer in the Senate, which is fascinating because his model is actually kind of scary to me because he says a lot of things. And you might say, hey, we've nodded along with him many times, says something good about Israel, maybe saying something good about one or two other things, maybe not as harsh on Trump as some other Democratic politicians. And that's all great. But let me just give you this from the story. Fetterman shared an article. He's trying to convince Democrats that he is liberal right now. He is among the least Trump aligned Democratic lawmakers with a voting record of 6% of the time. He's voting with Trump 6% of the time. Let's not overstate from our side how much of a buddy he is. That is important for us to remember. Also, in the world of sports, the most important story, of course, obviously, America's team, Toronto Blue Jays, were able to defeat the Mariners 13-4 last night. I had pretty much given up in the first inning, I have to admit. And they're still down 2-1, so there's dark things potentially around the corner, and it's probably going to ruin the show for a week or two. You'll just have to get used to that. And then finally, another thing that will probably ruin the show, we're going to talk about Angel Reese. Now, Angel Reese, you might remember her as being famous for not being as good as Caitlin Clark, and also her complaints about being sexualized when she became somewhat famous as a WNBA player. So what better way to deal with that problem to being overly sexualized than to go on the Victoria's Secret fashion show? She looks wonderful, however, in the pictures. So congratulations to Angel Reese. I suppose now people may actually sexualize you instead of it just happening in your imagination. So if that was your goal, I suppose you've been able to achieve that, unlike hitting a 6-foot jumper.
Alle ein Fest zum Aldi-Tiefpreis. Diese Woche Gourmet-Dessert-Törtchen. 6x30 Gramm für nur 2,89 Euro. Oder Gourmet-Frischkäse-Gipfel. 90 Gramm für nur 1,79 Euro. Entdecke viele weitere festliche Angebote. Jetzt bei Aldi Nord. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
I'm joined now by Josh Jennings, staff writer for the Glenn Beck Program. He has a brand new book out today. It's called Space Tractor and Other Science Fiction Short Stories. Be sure to check it out. Pick up a copy today. Josh, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, Stu. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Now, I wouldn't necessarily say that this program is your source for all science fiction breaking news.
Sure.
But you know, you've been working on this for a while. Yeah. And, of course, you come at it from a perspective. You work here, right?
Right.
You're looking at this world in a perspective of you love science fiction, but you're noticing something missing.
Yeah, so I've been reading science fiction and watching science fiction since I was a baby, or very young, and I noticed something in the last probably 15, 20 years that kind of the woke mind virus, the intersectional thinking that has pervaded our culture, really, really, really sank into the world of science fiction, and particularly print science fiction. So any given month, I'm reading Asimov's or Clark's World or Escape Pod, you know, Analog. These are the big guys who kind of inherited the science fiction world from the old magazines, the Amazing Stories and things like that.
Sure.
And any given month, if you crack into one of these things or you listen to their podcasts, which I tend to do a lot, about 80-85% of what you're going to get is stories about what I like to call the pronoun people. It's very much, it's like they found a niche and they have just dug their claws into it and they're sticking to it. And I look at that and the fiction that they're putting out isn't necessarily bad. A lot of it's actually pretty good. Mm-hmm. And I should also mention, like, I mean, a lot of it is about, you know, being transgender or some sort of transgender creature or whatever.
Right.
Okay, maybe science fiction is actually the best place for that.
Yes, yes, I would agree.
So I don't have a problem with them having a place at the table, but I just have noticed that they've pretty much taken up the entire table. Not the entire table, but the bigger share of it. And as a longtime writer, I mean, I've been writing for 25, 30 years at this point, and I love science fiction, and I love the expansiveness, and what it used to be was just this, the sky's the limit, and not even the sky's the limit, the universe is the limit. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to go back to that, and a few years ago, probably two and a half years ago, I discovered a podcast. It's called the Lost Sci-Fi Podcast, and for anybody who loves old science fiction, it's perfect. It's done by a professional audiobook narrator, and he just takes all of these old science fiction stories from Isaac Asimov and, you know, the people for whom the modern magazines are named, and he narrates these stories in a professional fashion. So I got hooked on that. And I couldn't stop. Every day I was listening to these stories. And I hadn't written anything of my own. I mean, I write obviously for Glenn, you know.
Sure.
But weirdly, he doesn't do a lot of science fiction.
Yeah, less than you would have thought. I would say.
So I hadn't really written anything in my own genre for a long time. I'd kind of just gotten busy as a father and a career and all of that. And one day I just started writing, and I was like, it hit me. This is what I want to produce. I want to create science fiction that's not political. It's just back to the idea of exploring ideas and having adventures and fun. And if you read my book, Space Tractor, the name is funny because the story that is in the book is a funny story. Mm-hmm. But there's everything. You're going to laugh. You're going to cry. Your jaw's going to drop a couple of times because I like a good surprise ending. And it's just, it's entertainment, but it also, some of it explores, you know, deeper subjects as well. And it's just it's my contribution to the idea that we should be able to bring back the golden age of science fiction or create a new one.
Yeah, kind of like the innocence of it, right? I mean, in a way. Because I know that there was controversy with Star Wars recently where there was you might know this story better than I do, but I do not.
Ahsoka or whatever, the woke Star Wars.
Yeah, like space vampire lesbians or something like that. I remember hearing that whole the conversation.
I never saw it, but I kind of gave up on a lot of the Star Wars
stuff. Me too. I kind of did too, and that's sad, right? I love Star Wars. I watched all the movies with my daughter, like, you know, she likes likes some of the movies better, more than I think, you know,
than they deserve.
Yeah, probably.
We're talking about the prequels. I know how this goes.
That's how that works. But like, none of that stuff has to be involved in it. Right. And I'm not asking like for a dissertation in the middle of it on low taxes either. Like, nice. It would be nice if they just like presented good, amazing stories that you can talk about after and kind of like, you know, get your imagination going.
Exactly. That is exactly it. And it's that more than anything else is my goal. Like my goal in writing a book is always like, is there politics in it? Maybe, but it's at the back. Mm-hmm. Is there, you know, philosophy in it? Maybe, but it's usually at the back. The main thing is I want to tell you a good story. And by the time that I'm done telling you that story, when you read that last page and you put this book down, I hope that your first thought is going to be, when does the next one come out?
Mm. It reminds me sort of talking to Eric July over the over the past couple of years. He went down the same road, except in the comic book world. Right,
exactly.
And kept seeing like, hey, there's something wrong here. The stories aren't the main thing anymore.
Yeah.
And you got to keep the main thing the main thing.
That's right. I believe Yogi Berra said that, maybe?
Something like that. I think of it from Jalen Hurts, but it's somebody. Said it.
They're the same person.
Yeah, pretty much. I'm pretty sure. We were talking about this yesterday, that there was a drop for the first time in a long time in the percentage of people who identify as LGBTQQIA2+.
Right.
That wasn't something that necessarily was foreseen, right? Like, and it seems like a reaction to the world, which kind of says something about the science of all of it.
Right.
Why would they start going down again?
Right.
It does seem like we've turned the corner on that. Do you think we've turned the corner on this when it comes to entertainment as well? Because, I mean, you still have a lot of the farthest left people that are in charge of this stuff.
Of course. I mean, it's hard to really peer into the crystal ball and know for sure. But what I see out of it is, I said this at the beginning, I have no problem with there being a seat at the table for people with views that they want to write about that I don't agree with.
Yeah, sure.
I welcome it. Some of it really is good fiction, even if I'm like burning mad the whole time, you know?
Right.
What I would love to see, and I do think you're seeing some of this, is I would love to see an equalizing movement, something I think we're ever going to get completely rid of like woke Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
No, not really. And I don't know that we would want to, because I think there's a creative force in at work that largely lives in the left that is mm-hmm. useful in places. It creates some beauty.
Mm-hmm.
It then destroys that beauty usually and like bulldozes it over and all that. But
I don't. It's a homeless encampment.
Yes,
built there,
exactly. And, yeah. but I don't want to get rid of that entirely. What I do want to see is equalizing things. So for example, you talked about Eric July. That's a great example. I love what he's doing. Mm-hmm. I love that you have things like Angel Studios that mm-hmm. have been actually coming to some prominence, and they're able to make higher end looking movies. And so I want to see more of that. And I mean, there's definitely a lot of nascent evidence right now that may be where we're headed. Unfortunately, I think a lot of it will depend on where our politics goes. I wish that it wasn't that way, but I do think that it will. So, you know, if 5 years from now you and I are talking about how cool is it that we have President Vance, then mm-hmm. yeah, maybe this will continue on. If 5 years from now you and I are in a gulag somewhere.
under President AOC.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Then, you know, maybe it'll take a little while longer before it can crawl out from the dust and rise like the phoenix.
Well, I will say, this is great gulag reading right here.
Yes.
If you're going to be in a gulag, you might as well read some fun science fiction.
The great thing about it is when you're done with it, you can eat it.
There you go. I'm sure it's great advice. Space Tractor and other science fiction short stories, kind of a throwback to the old printed stories and the sci-fi world, and hopefully a throwback to some sanity as well. Josh, thanks so much for coming on the program. Congratulations.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay, so here's what happened. In Chicago, a city that was named recently the country's rattiest city for the 10th consecutive year by pest control service Orkin, had something called the Chicago Rat Hole. What is the Chicago Rat Hole? What they think happened, or at least the theory was, a rat was out in the street and it got maybe caught in wet cement, and then maybe a cement roller ran over the rat, pressed it into the cement itself. It formed a shape of a rat. The rat either got up or just disintegrated. We don't know. And it came up with this sort of hole. This is the hole. Now, people come to this place. They could see. You could see the paw and everything. And they just put, like, stuff in there to fill it up, like, almost like a weird, I don't know. They call it splatatooey. Anyway, terrible news for those Chicago rat hole lovers. We just found, scientifically, the Chicago rat hole was not made by a rat. They say it was a squirrel hole this entire time. Learn new things every day.